Funding for the Think Podcast comes from TCU, where researchers strive to develop sustainable solutions to protect the world's fresh water supply. You can learn more at endeavors.tcu.edu. Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
By now, you've surely heard of CTE, short for chronic traumatic encephalopathy. Last year, the NFL's highest-ranking health and safety officer publicly acknowledged a link between pro football's skull-jarring collisions and this progressive and devastating brain disease. But here's the thing. The multiple head injuries that cause CTE don't just start once an athlete goes pro. They can begin with concussions sustained in youth sports. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. A project called Context is now tracking concussions in school-age Texas athletes. Later in the hour, we'll speak with two physicians from UT Southwestern Medical Center about the database and its goals. But first, the story of Zach Easter, an all-American Midwestern kid who seemed to have everything going for him, but whose life was cut short as a result of the multiple head injuries he sustained and played through in middle and high school. Journalist Reed Forgrave wrote his story for GQ magazine. He joins us from the studios of Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul. Reed, welcome to Think.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So Zach Easter was born into a family that lives and breathes football. Can you tell us about how he grew up?
This is, and I say this as a guy who lived in Iowa for a decade, this is your typical football-loving, hunting, gun-loving Midwestern Iowa rural family. Zach's dad was a college football player, played Division I football, and then went on to become a college football coach at a Division III school in small-town Iowa. All three of their sons, Zach was the middle boy out of three, all three of them played football. In the town that he grew up in, Indianola, Iowa, they called it the Easter mentality. And essentially it was a macho mentality. It was the mentality of, be tough, don't complain. It's very much the mentality that football coaches love to have in their players, guys who will put their body on the line for the game. And that's very much the environment that Zach grew up in.
He had an older brother who was maybe built a little more ideally for football than he was. So from an early age, he cultivated this reputation as the kid who instead would play through any kind of pain.
Yes, and this was what came to catch up with him later in life, and unfortunately not that much later in life. Zach would lead with his head. This is what coaches say that, you know, they never teach and they always teach against. Never lead with your head. Form tackling in football. But Zach took pride in being fearsome, in people being scared of him. Not scared of him because he was some physical behemoth. He wasn't 6'4", 250 with rippling muscles. His brother was a bigger guy than him. He was a better athlete than him. But what Zach was, more than anyone else in the family, he was fearless. And, on the football field, someone who is willing to do that, as much as a coach says, be careful, don't lead with the head, a coach still appreciates and says, look, you want to be like Zach Easter.
How many concussions did he suffer?
As a football player, there were at least four diagnosed concussions. He had two other diagnosed concussions after his football career. But he guesses that he had a dozen or more that just weren't diagnosed. I mean, he talks about in middle school playing through massive headaches while playing football. This is a kid who started playing, I think it would have been Pop Warner football as early as, I think, third grade. And look, like I said before, he is someone who, he was reckless, but he was reckless in a way that we appreciate in our football heroes. He took a badge of honor in that. His favorite player was Brett Favre of the Green Bay Packers. And Brett Favre was a gunslinger. He was the most reckless, beautiful quarterback perhaps in all of NFL history. And Zach, I think his mentality was very much modeled after that.
So people know about the problem of repeated concussions among college players, certainly NFL players. These head injuries were all sustained in sports Zach Easter played as a child before the end of high school.
And that to me is what, why there's been such a strong response to this story, because parents look at Zach Easter, they look at his personality, and they also look at kind of when he did play sports, and he's the boy next door. He could be any of our sons. He could be any of our brothers. He could be any of our neighbors or classmates. He did not play any college athletics. In fact, after his third concussion his senior year, he had three his senior year. After that third concussion, which ended his football career, he went up to the school's trainer about a month later, and he wanted to wrestle. He was also really big into wrestling, which is a huge sport in rural Iowa. And the trainer said, no, she said, I am not going to allow you to do that sport because of all the things that have already happened to your head.
What did Zach do? How did he realize that the symptoms he was experiencing were indicative of CTE or chronic traumatic encephalopathy?
Right around when he was graduating from college, and this would have been about 2 years ago, he went to a college, a small college in Des Moines, Iowa, and he started experiencing some pretty serious symptoms, things like just being very forgetful, driving back to his childhood home, the place that he lived for 15 years, and getting lost, going to the hardware store and going for two things and wandering around the hardware store not knowing why he was there. Clearly, there was a problem here. He got his first full-time job out of college, and it was a sales job, and he had to make a lot of cold calls on the phone, and he literally had to, word for word, write out what his sales script was going to be, because if he didn't, his brain would get foggy, and he would just get lost in the middle of a script. So he started going to doctors. This would have been in about 2015, so not that long ago. And went to all sorts of different doctors to try to figure out what was going on. And there was one doctor who told him, you were exhibiting symptoms of what could be CTE. CTE is not something that can be, for sure diagnosed until, someone's dead, that you need to actually look at the brain. But he was exhibiting these symptoms of it. And he, of course, went online, started researching it. And that's really when it started to scare the crap out of him, because he started hearing these stories, stories that had kind of been in and out of the news the past several years. But players like Mike Webster from those Steel Curtain Pittsburgh Steelers, like Junior Seau, like Dave Duerson from the Chicago Bears, stories of NFL players who committed suicide and who had this same brain disease that Zach was told he was exhibiting symptoms of. It was for a 24-year-old man who in many ways the world was his oyster, it was absolutely terrifying to him.
Reed, part of the reason that you know Zach so well is, in addition to your reporting, he kept a journal, a memoir of sorts. And it's really chilling, the parts that you include, because he's aware of the extent to which his brain is malfunctioning. He knows these symptoms are not normal. He can't control them. He knows he's using drugs and alcohol in counterproductive ways. He knows his relationships are not working, but he can't find any relief.
What is amazing about these journals is how self-aware he is. And that's what's so chilling about it. It's like a young man who is losing his brain, who's losing his mind in real time and knows that it's happening. In many ways, these journals that he left behind, one of them was kind of a 40 or 50 page, what I kind of think of as his autobiography, where he sat down at a computer and said, this is my life and this is my life in regard to football, in regard to concussions. Other ones are, Dear Diary. They're, pretty much recording his struggle with what ends up later being diagnosed as CTE, experiencing this in real time. And what you see is a man who's having these mood swings, these vicious mood swings, where one day he is on top of the world because he is determined that he is going to conquer this. And the next day he's drinking, he's using drugs, he's basically saying, screw it, like life ain't worth it. And he did, and I know this is kind of getting ahead in our chronology a little bit, but he did commit suicide December, about 13 months ago, so December 2015. And when you read his journals, this was all very planned out, and he very much wanted his story to be shared. In a way, I see these journals as a perverse sort of blessing that he left behind for his family, because in one way they are an explanation. And when you read these journals, you kind of say almost there was nothing else that could have been done. There were things that could have been done, but you can see where Zach got to the point that he lost all hope. And then the other part of these journals are he gives his family, especially his parents, he gives them a charge. He gives them instructions going forward. And those instructions are basically take his tragedy and spread it. And, you know, listen to Zach. Tell people who play football, be careful. Take these brain things very seriously because the brain ain't like a broken arm. It can't just heal in 6 to 8 weeks. You don't have an x-ray that can tell you it's broken. You need to be extra careful when it comes to things like this. And in many ways, I think Zach came to see that as the meaning of his too short life.
It's a heartbreaking story in any case, but I was especially touched by the fact that Zach believed it was wrong to kill himself, but he just couldn't see another way.
He was a religious man. His family was a, you know, pretty devout Catholic family. And, you know, the Catholic Church, certainly doesn't look fondly upon suicide. But I actually spoke with his, and this wasn't in the story, but I spoke with his military chaplain. He later joined the National Guard, was not deployed abroad, but he was kind of a weekend warrior for a couple of years. And I spoke with his military chaplain, who became very close with the family after Zach's death, about suicide. And one aspect of it is that, you know, we always think of suicide as sort of the most selfish thing that someone can do because it doesn't think of the loved ones around you. And in a weird way, this isn't exactly what the chaplain said, but the family's come to think of his suicide as, I guess you'd call it a sacrifice of sorts, that he believed he could improve the world more by dying, which is so heartbreaking to think of, than by continuing to live the nightmare that his life had become. You read his journals and he says, I'm taking the easy way out. I know that I'm doing this and I shouldn't be doing this, but I can't deal with this anymore. I'm never going to get better. One psychologist told him, Zach, you're going to be penniless, homeless, and in a mental institution. And if you're told at age 24 that is going to be your future, it's pretty hard to not get to a pretty bleak place about it.
He was very explicit about his dying wishes, one of which was to have his brain donated to science. It was examined in the lab of Dr. Bennett Omalu, who was the first to publish conclusive findings on the toll of CTE on NFL players. What did those tests reveal?
Those tests revealed that he did, in fact, have CTE, this same disease that, you know, all these NFL players have come down with. It was pretty jarring to hear that of a kid who only played football through age 18 would actually, that it wasn't just, you know, in his mind that he was experiencing these symptoms, that it was very real, that his brain had degenerated to that point. But to the family, it was also, there was a sense of relief in a way when he was diagnosed. And that would have been, I think, about 5 months after his death is when they got an email from Dr. Omalu that said, yes, he did, in fact, have CTE. And to the family, I think that provided a sense of closure, an explanation, and in a way, a fact that Zach hadn't died in vain, that what he thought was happening to him was actually happening to him. And that they could kind of go forth and spread his story, do things like they're lobbying the Iowa legislature this year on return to play protocol after a high school athlete gets concussions, lobbying the legislature on having trainers who are trained in concussions to be present at every single varsity game of a contact sport. This family, I think, in a way, it gives some meaning to this awful, senseless tragedy.
Reed, thank you so much for being with us. It was a really great piece of reporting, and I appreciate your time.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Find a link to Reed Forgrave's GQ article, The Concussion Diaries, One High School Football Player's Secret Struggle with CTE, at think.kera.org. Just ahead, the effort to build a database tracking concussions in school-age athletes in Texas. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Thank you. funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening master's program for working professionals. You can apply now for the summer of 2017. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. In the last segment, we heard the story of Zach Easter, who died of suicide at 24 after struggling with chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE, a brain disease attributed to the multiple concussions he suffered as a high school football player. So what's the risk to other kids playing contact sports in high school or earlier? A statewide database of school-age athletes in Texas is collecting information on the incidence of concussions in kids with the goal of collecting statistics and spotting patterns in who gets hurt and how well they recover. You can find a link to more information about the Texas Sports Concussion Registry, CONTEXT for short, at think.kera.org. Joining us to talk about the database and about the effects of concussions on still-developing brains, we have two experts. Dr. Hunt Bacher is chair of the Department of Neurological Surgery at UT Southwestern. Dr. Monroe Cullum is a neuropsychologist at UT Southwestern. Gentlemen, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
I've read up on concussions before, but every time I'm a little surprised by just how fragile and soft the brain is. Why is it susceptible to injury after we suffer a blow to the skull?
Well, it is a soft organ. It's gelatinous, or a little bit like Jell-O. And the head is a fixed box. And that's a hard wall to the box, the skull. And it's an irregular box. So as the brain slides in its fluid bath, as we walk or if we have a sudden blow to the head, that can distort the brain. It's very soft. The two hemispheres are connected. And as rotational forces act on the brain particularly, that can disrupt some of the deep circuits that connect various aspects of our function.
That was Dr. Bacher you just heard. Dr. Cullum, can we also sustain a concussion without a direct hit?
Yes. The head does not actually have to be hit for the brain to be jostled enough to sustain a concussion. A strong hit to the body, for example, with a snapping motion of the head. The brain, as Dr. Bacher described, is encased in the skull. So if the skull stops moving abruptly, the brain might keep moving a little bit, and there can be stretching and shearing forces on some of the deep brain tissue that cause concussion symptoms.
How do doctors determine how severe a concussion is?
I would say the emphasis is not on severity anymore. I would say a loss of consciousness would be on the severe end. But only 10% of concussions result in loss of consciousness. So it's really what's much more important to me is the presence or absence of concussive symptoms rather than severity.
And what are those symptoms that we can look for?
They can be in a variety of domains. And when I was training, it was if you were knocked out, you had a head injury. Mm-hmm. If you weren't, they'd kick you till you got back up and went out on the field. That's obviously not the case anymore. Kids can say, I've got a headache, or an exercise-induced headache, or my coordination's off, my balance is off. I feel in a fog. I've had a ding. These are all very common terminologies for kids and grown-ups that have sustained a concussion. Light bothers their eyes. Sound bothers them if they're in a loud environment like a stadium. Those are all symptoms of concussion.
So one or both of you, I'm curious to know how the idea to formally track concussions arose and why this was thought to be important in Texas.
Well, it's an idea we've had for a long time. We're involved in the provision of clinical care for patients with concussion. We're also involved in concussion research and have been for a long time. And no states at the time really actually know how many concussions are occurring in any particular year. Hawaii started a program a couple of years ago, so they began documenting. And we came up with the idea actually through our local efforts of another study that we're doing to take our current study and make it statewide to begin to get some estimate of how many injuries like this are occurring each year.
That sounds simple enough, but I would imagine that lots of different school districts have lots of different policies in terms of how they report these things. Was it easy to get everybody on the same page?
No. No, it's, you know, when you think about a state the size of Texas with 800,000 plus youth athletes, it's a little bit of a daunting policy. But we do have one state law, and that's Natasha's Law, taken from the Zeit-Leistat Law. So there has to be accountability to be in compliance with that law. So that gives us some natural allies, the University Interscholastic League, the Texas State Athletic Trainers Association, for example, under Spanky Stevens, very much on board with making sure that across the state, not just in Dallas and Houston and Austin, across the state, the small towns, that the kids have access to proper surveillance, diagnosis, and care. And what I want out of it is the capability, a platform from which we can study new innovative strategies. And to learn about, let's say, a community or a school district has very bad outcomes or very prolonged return to learn or return to play. What's going on there? Or if they're way too short, what's going on there? So those are areas where we can come in and do a deeper dive.
It took us well over a year to get the project off the ground. There were many legal and contractual challenges. But it is now off the ground, and we've actually contacted through the UIL. They have contacted all superintendents across the state, and it's up to the superintendents to get their athletic trainers or other school personnel signed up to be part of our program. So that's the phase we're at now. So we're really trying to encourage good participation.
And historically, just to follow up Monroe's point, the UIL was tracking only boys football. And girls and women are probably uniquely vulnerable to athletic head injuries.
Why is that?
You know, it's an area of a lot of research that's going on. It is possible that it's something as simple and mechanical as the shoulder girdle and the neck size as a buttress against forces against the head. It may be hormonal. It may be launch angles that women use that are different than men. We don't really have that sorted out, but this is a way that we'll at least be tracking to see really what the incidence is in girls' sports.
So we know because of the NFL that concussions are a particular risk for people who play contact sports. Lots of people think, though, if you have a helmet on, that you are protected. What do we need to know about that?
Well, we need to know that a helmet does not protect you from a concussion. As Dr. Bajor will also, I've heard him lecture many times talking about how football helmets were first developed to eliminate death and skull fracture, which they've done a pretty reasonable job over the years. They were not developed to prevent concussion. And in fact, obviously, if a player feels invulnerable when they're wearing a helmet, they might behave more aggressively with the helmet on than a helmet off. So we don't have any concussion-proof helmets.
Is anybody looking at different designs? Like, I know there's foam in a lot of them, right? Could there be a helmet that contained fluid in the same way that the skull contains fluid?
The answer is yes. There are going to be a lot of new possibilities. Our NFL Head, Neck, and Spine Committee is focused on that as the number one priority. Let's get a helmet that takes the head out of sports. I can make you one tonight in my garage that will eliminate concussions, but the players will all be quadriplegic from neck injuries because
it's
of the
too
bulk,
heavy.
The bulk of the device. So it's going to take some very interesting engineering, and that is one of the things that we are heavily involved with our engineering connections at UT Dallas and UT Austin to do just that. But it's not going to look like our current shell helmet.
What about sports where you don't wear a helmet, like soccer, where the best players are the ones who have really good control of that ball that comes at them, you know, very quickly?
Well, you're never going to eliminate concussions in sports. And people need to keep in mind, too, that the number one cause or location of sport-related concussion or athletic physical-related concussion is in kids falling off of bicycles. That's number one. If you look at the CDC website, that's above football and everything else. So we don't want to, you know, bubble wrap all of our kids and make the world concussion proof. It's not going to happen. We need to teach best practices in terms of, for example, in soccer, heading the ball. There's some mixed information out there about how dangerous is heading for cognitive function, and it looks like if your brain is aged enough, i.e. you're late adolescence, early adulthood, and you're hitting the ball properly in an intelligent fashion, there don't seem to be big negative effects of doing that. But that depends a lot upon the individual, the physical stature, musculature, et cetera.
In the first segment, we heard the story of Zach Easter, who seems like he was a really good kid, but he really wanted to play football and would lie to his coaches and his trainer about the injuries and the symptoms that he was experiencing. How do we encourage kids who know that they will be benched if they report concussion symptoms to be honest about it?
That's a complicated and very good question. I'll add two layers to it. I would say one layer is that some of the key research that we have to do is understanding vulnerabilities to the manifestations of head injury. I believe that there are genetic susceptibilities for people that it doesn't take much to create long-term damage, and that there are others that are incredibly resistant. So I think that's an element that we have not gotten the answer to. That's going to take some longitudinal research with blood in a test tube that stays there for a long time to look at outcomes. So I think that's one. The second is when we took over the NFL Head, Neck, and Spine Committee several years ago, talk about a cultural motivation to play.
Yeah.
It's powerful, it's financial, and it's competitive. These people want to be on the field winning. It took years to change that culture, to make our NFL athletes realize that it's dangerous to their health to not report. In fact, not this current season, but one before, there was a huge spike in the number of concussions in the NFL. And it was self-reported injuries that weren't reported on Sunday when it happened, but Tuesday or Wednesday, as they were increasing their activities, and they were coming forward saying, I'm not feeling right, Doc. So I think that's a tremendous cultural advance. What happens at the NFL trickles down fast to the lower levels of play.
We're speaking this hour with Dr. Hunt Bacher and Dr. Monroe Cullum of UT Southwestern Medical Center. They are coordinators of the Texas Sports Concussion Registry, or CONTECS. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Josh calling from Granbury. Hi, Josh.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, so with cigarettes pose a high enough risk of pulmonary and cardiac complications and cancers that we don't allow minors to have them. Is there a percentage, like a likelihood of concussion, like a numerical threshold where he would say it's likely enough that a student, like a minor, will incur a concussion of some kind, and that's a significant enough risk that we will prevent them from playing particular contact sport?
Thanks so much for your question, Josh.
Well, it's a complicated question. As Dr. Bacher said earlier, right now we don't fully know who's at risk for concussion symptoms or persistent problems after concussion, and it's going to take a lot of research for that. We do know that younger brains are more vulnerable, though, so protecting younger kids, not maybe allowing them to, have as many contacts with their head at younger and younger ages. But we need to learn who's at risk for this injury and the prolonged symptoms. That's one of the goals of our studies that we're doing through the O'Donnell Brain Institute, is to learn more about recovery patterns and some of the demographic factors, and eventually looking at blood-based biomarkers and other genetic factors that may contribute to this.
I would add two points. One, in children in particular, it is critical that we make the diagnosis whether they've fallen off a bicycle or got hit on the sports field, because kids, unlike adults, are vulnerable to what's called the second impact syndrome, which is a phenomenon where before a child has recovered from a concussion, they get hit again, and that can be fatal or devastating. Zachary Leistat suffered exactly that complication in Seattle area. So that's we've got to be very, very cautious with kids. I think probably related to what Dr. Cullum just said, I think there is probably an age threshold below which they shouldn't have contact sports. We don't know what that number is, but we need to do the kinds of studies that will help us with it. What matters to me, seeing patients with the problem, is recovery time. If you see return to school, return to play, that after one concussion is a week, the next one it's a month, and the next one is 2 months, that's the end of the season, and in children, possibly the end of sport. So I think those are all elements of it's a very challenging question that was posed.
What do you say to people our age who say, look, when I was a kid, I, got X number of dings, and I don't know if they were concussions because nobody took us to the doctor back then. And how bad can it possibly be for my kids? For people who really don't feel like they suffered any long-term effects, how do you convince them?
Well, actually, the majority of people who sustain concussion recover rather completely, rather quickly. So most of us that have had concussions are back to normal within a few days. So that's really the majority. There's a small but significant minority, somewhere around 10%, that do have prolonged symptoms. And those are the cases that are complex and we don't understand as well. We need to learn more about those, who's at risk, and then also what is the best treatment for them. The old days of saying just go to sleep and rest, or if they do go to sleep, wake them up every hour. We've learned a lot of things that you don't want to be doing nowadays. But there's still more we have to learn about. For example, how much rest, what type of rest is best for which individual?
Are there medicines that work specifically to heal the injury, not just to deal with symptoms?
To date, the answer to that would be no. We know that time allows the individual to heal. A number of, you name it, so many things have been tried. And hyperbaric oxygen recently in the military theaters for injured soldiers, all the studies were negative so far.
Meaning they didn't work?
They did not work. And it's not exactly translatable into schoolboy, schoolgirl sports. But I think that's a study actually I would love to embark on, deploying it very early after the injury to see if there may be some benefit. It may be harmful. We just don't know.
We're speaking this hour with two men behind the Texas Sports Concussion Registry, or CONTACS, Dr. Hunt Bacher and Dr. Monroe Cullum, both of whom are at UT Southwestern Medical Center. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, where students can customize their degree, like Diane Jay, internationally published creative writer. More at smu.edu/DLS.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My two guests this hour are Dr. Monroe Cullum, who is a neuropsychologist at UT Southwestern Medical Center, and Dr. Hunt Bacher, who is chair of the Department of Neurological Surgery at UT Southwestern Medical Center. Together, they have been champions of the Texas Sports Concussion Registry, or CONTACS. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. The first segment, to go back to our conversation about Zach Easter, who died of suicide. After his death, it was demonstrated that he had CTE. How is CTE diagnosed among athletes who currently have it and are living with it?
The current state of the art is that you cannot diagnose CTE in the living person. It's an autopsy diagnosis. And what we're seeing too much of, and there's a very good example in a Canadian hockey player who started having symptoms of depression and other difficulties in his 40s, was told he probably had it, assumed he had it because of all the publicity that's going into this, and not willing to have his children watch him die of a degenerative brain disease, he took his own life. Hmm. His autopsy was negative. He was depressed, and he needed care. So I think a really important element here is to get a thorough, if a former athlete or former soldier is having trouble, get good studies and good advice about what the diagnosis is and what the opportunities for treatment are, because often somebody like that individual could have been saved.
Are the treatment decisions different if you're not certain that someone has CTE, but you suspect it? I mean, how do you know we'll just treat you for depression as opposed to we'll suggest that you live your life as if you have CTE?
Well, the symptoms of depression, regardless of etiology, are treatable in the same fashion as in non-head injury-related depression symptoms. So the treatments work for depression.
1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org. Let's go next on the phone to Aaron in Bedford. Hi, Aaron.
Hi, great show. Long-time listener. Appreciate the public service you're providing.
Thank you.
Hey, I'm a coach. I've dealt with a lot of kids in sports. But if our responsibility is to report to the UIL for age, a correct age for kids competing, and also for grades. And obviously, that's a venue or an ability to report things. Would it be easier just to report to the CDC when kids are diagnosed with concussions? And my other part to my question is, improvement in equipment in protecting people, athletes, students, in an environment that requires protecting. And I've heard a lot of people, friends of mine telling me, no, we want the sport to be rough. No, that's why they have helmets. I'll take my answer off here.
Thanks for your call. Lots of questions wrapped up in one there.
Right.
I think the idea, Aaron, it's a very good question about the CDC. And first of all, the CDC is our friend, not our opposition. And they are, the idea behind context is that we would collect the data for Texas athletes. That data is going to be shared when we have findings. That would go straight with the CDC, and they have helped us in so many aspects of player safety over the years. So it's not like these are separate silos. They're connected, and I would hope that we can join with other states to broaden the net. I think that's where this is going, and perhaps it'll be national one day, an identical platform for collecting exactly the same data. So we will really learn if it's different in Hawaii than it is in Texas.
Go ahead.
Yeah, the CDC actually would like to see nationwide concussion statistics. And we're starting in Texas, which has the largest number of student athletes of any state. And we're actually will be partnering with other state organizations, other universities and research institutes to begin this sort of collection and pooling of data. We do hope it goes national at some point.
Setting aside CTE, is there evidence that isolated concussions in childhood or adolescence might be associated with cognitive problems decades down the road?
That is a great question. Some of our research at UT Southwestern, using some national databases, have shown an association at a large group level that if somebody is going to develop cognitive loss later in life, whether that be to Alzheimer's disease or mild cognitive impairment, they may have the onset of symptoms a couple of years earlier. That relationship, though, it does not apply to individuals, so we can't, again, tell who's at risk for that. And we must keep in mind that the vast majority of these injuries, people recover with no subsequent problems, later life or early life problems afterwards. So we're talking about a subgroup of people that we need to understand more about their genetics and their own background as well.
Dale Hansen was moderating an event, I think it was last year, with Mike Singletary, Monroe, Kathy Bell, from Southwestern and myself, and he was asking us how many concussions we'd had, and Mike said zero, a fierce player, Hall of Famer. And he asked me how many I'd had. I said, well, about at least five. And he said, you're a baseball player. How the heck could you get five concussions? I said, well, I don't have a neck that looks like Mike's.
If we get to a point where we can identify the risk factors that cause one person to be more susceptible to severe effects from concussions than another, or to suffer concussions in the first place, would it make sense to think about policies that exclude those individuals from youth sports before they start playing?
I think that's a challenging question that we may someday face. Right now, you know, certain kids are you know, lean towards certain sports. I would have loved to have been an NFL player myself, but as Dr. Bader said, Mike Singletary, his neck is bigger than my leg, so I just didn't have the body type or probably the mindset for it. And it, you know, every sport, it requires its own individual aspects, unique characteristics, and not only physical but psychological as well. And in terms of you know, trying to route kids to one sport or another, I think we do need to pay attention to body size, body types, as well as their own aggressive or non-aggressive instincts as well.
I think we can educate, but you know, there are certain aspects of, you know, freedom and decision making. Getting to the cigarette question we heard earlier,
yeah.
We know cigarettes are bad for you, and some people choose even now to continue to smoke. A fellow named Singletary, when he first went to try out for his team, the coach told him, "Son, you're too small." Well, you know what? He got big. He conditioned himself. He disciplined himself. He worked like crazy. And he's in the Hall of Fame, cognitively perfect. Yet you wouldn't want to characterize a body size or something as being an exclusion. There are just a lot of different factors involved.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. Let's speak with David in Tyler. Hi, David.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Very well, thanks.
Okay, I had two questions and one comment. You guys had really covered a lot of things that I was thinking already, so I appreciate you having this on. My first question was, I've been playing football since I was probably 12 years old, and all the way through college, and even semi-pro football. And what I wanted to know was, where does, like, flashes of light, like when I used to have impact, I played defense. When I used to have impact like his, whether it's like high speed or just powerful impacts, not even that much really. Just I know what you guys already talked about as far as the concussion spectrum goes, but where does that fall on the like a concussion level? Because even all the way when I was a kid, probably like during practice and games, probably 2-3 times during practice and in games, multiple times where I hit somebody and just have like a flash of light.
Wow, I have not experienced that.
I have, and you know, when I was young and playing, that sort of event was a non-event. We're telling the athletes now to report it, that it's there's no reason that, and you see the impact. We watch it on videos. It's enormous impact, and maybe all they had was a flash of light. So I think that is what we're asking our players to report now, and we're calling it concussion.
We don't know the physiology of it, if that's the question. Not sure why some people experience that, but no two concussions are alike. Everyone's concussions are a little bit different, although they do fall in the mood and cognitive and physical area. Syndromes, if you will, but we don't know where some of the symptoms exactly come from. We also know that some of the big hits you see sometimes don't result in concussion, and you may see a minor hit that does result. So there's so much we have to learn. That's why it's actually a very exciting time in brain injury research right now.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour with Dr. Monroe Cullum and Dr. Hunt Bacher about the Texas Sports Concussion Registry, or CONTECS. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Let's go next to Blake in Fort Worth. Hi, Blake.
Hey, how are y'all doing?
Very well, thanks.
Awesome. Well, I just wanted to say thank you for everybody that's doing this, all the concussion research. I played a lot of sports in high school. I played rugby for 3 years, and I have a polite total of 23 concussions. Some of those ended up being just like the guy that was just on the phone with flashes of light. At one point I saw red in one eye and blue in the other. So there's a lot of weird stuff that can happen. So concussions are very tricky. But my question that I had was in regards of like the high school stuff and the middle school stuff, you have, you know, I guess testosterone drops after a certain amount of time playing a sport or working out or any sort of activity. So are we seeing an increase of injuries specifically concussions as well, towards the end of these longer sport, these longer games, like football games can go for a very long time with timeouts and anything like that. Are we seeing, you know, I guess like a, you know, lapse of judgment towards the end of the game that could result in, you know, lowering your head too much and hitting a helmet or anything like that?
That's an interesting question, Blake. Thank you.
I think probably fatigue does play a role in allowing the kinds of impacts you're talking about, and unfortunately, so does targeting, you know, late in the game. That is an issue that we are coping with at the NFL. But I think we have to discipline our young players to be aware of it and avoid it. Make better decisions.
The old trope is that coaches are grudgingly following these new regulations. My very limited personal experience is that coaches actually care very much about the brains of their young athletes. I wonder what your sense of this is around the state.
That's a great question. And initially, there was speculation that, you know, how are the coaches going to react to this? How are the trainers going to react? Will you get people participating? So our context study is voluntary in this first year. The UIL would like to make it mandatory, perhaps next season. But our experience has been much like you describe. The coaches we've talked to, the trainers we've talked to, they don't want their kids out there risking themselves if they're in an injured state. We talked earlier about the information about concussion, letting your teammates know if you're not fully up to speed, whether it's your ankle or your brain, you're not going to be at your best to help your buddies or your coach win a game. So we've actually had a quite good response from coaches as well as, and particularly parents too.
I think, you know, Australian rugby has taught us that players that have a significant impact, even though they're not abnormal when they're tested at the sideline, put them back on field, they are impaired compared to their baseline. And we've seen it in missed plays at all levels of play that maybe a terrific athlete is left on the field and they're not terrific after that injury. So I think our educational message to the coaches is that you don't want those kids on the field. A, it's unsafe for them, but two, it's not good for your team. But I think there's a lot of ownership. Things have changed. The coaches take a lot of paternal or maternal attachment with their kids, and they want what's best for them. It's not about the game. It's about their life.
Should students all have some kind of baseline cognitive function test before they start playing sports?
That's a great question that is also debated amongst the general population as well as amongst neuropsychologists and neurologists, neurosurgeons across the country. The baseline testing has really caught on and done a number of really good things for us. It's helped draw attention to the nature of the injury and the importance of taking this seriously. It's gained parental awareness for us. It's helpful in cases where there might be a pre-existing condition like an attention deficit disorder or a learning disability, such that if after an injury someone scores low on the attention subtests, we can really identify it was related to the concussion and was not a pre-existing condition.
Dr. Monroe Cullum is a neuropsychologist at UT Southwestern Medical Center. Dr. Hunt Bacher is chair of the Department of Neurological Surgery at UT Southwestern. You can find information about the Texas Sports Concussion Registry at think.kera.org. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. And I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day. We'll